Now, what's happening to those cardiomyocytes that's allowing them to regenerate? Well, this is the key question. And the most prominent feature that we've been able to associate with regenerating cardiomyocytes is that they become less differentiated in structure and in gene expression. And so we can look at their differentiation status in a few different ways. For instance, by electron microscopy to look at sarcomere organization and cardiomyocytes. But I think this is the most visual way. And this is a these are images using a transgenic line made in Debbie Yellen's lab in which GFP was targeted to the Z bands of sarcomeres in cardiomyocytes. So if you look at a section showing cardiomyocytes of an uninjured zebrafish ventricle, you can see nicely organized sarcomeres in those myocytes. However, after an injury, and this is an ablation injury that I'm showing you, so we add tamoxifen, you can see that the half or more of the cardiomyocytes that are spared and are regenerating show a much less organized structure. That's a transient phenotype. By 1 month after the injury, when we've seen these muscle cells already regenerate, the sarcomere organization looks much more normal. Now, we can associate this with a more primitive or less differentiated phenotype because we see the same observations in embryonic cardiomyocytes. Callum McRae, who I mentioned earlier, has also done electrophysiology in cardiomyocytes during these stages of regeneration. And he sees their physiological characteristics also as being much more similar to embryonic cardiomyocytes. I think the most prominent feature that we've seen in cardiomyocytes undergoing regeneration is the acquisition of a more primitive phenotype. We've been looking at markers for this transition, as well as trying to get at this by generating new functional tools. And again, for the purpose of this talk, which is more of a summary of these two approaches we're taking, I won't get too much into molecules and so on, but I just want to say that the clearest feature of these cardiomyocytes that are regenerating and undergoing these changes are the induction of embryonic programs that are important for the initial development of cardiomyocytes in embryos, or for embryonic heart development. And for those of you familiar with heart development, there are several transcription factors that have been shown to mark cells that are part of the heart field, of cardiac progenitors turning into myocytes, and of early cardiomyocytes, and also that are important for heart development. For us, the most visual one of these is the GATA4 transcription factor. We've been using a very convenient strain made in Todd Evans' group in which that reports GFP from GATA4 regulatory sequences. These are sections through adult ventricles. And what you can see here is that normally these regulatory sequences are not activated, but upon injury, removing, in this case, 20% of the apex, we can see activation of these sequences. These are in cardiomyocytes. They co-stain nicely with muscle markers, starting at 7 days after injury, continuing in there at 14 days, and even at 30 days after we see a wall of new muscle. We see that the regenerating cardiomyocytes in all of these stages continue to express and activate the regulatory sequences for GATA4. We've looked at other transcription factors that may not show such a striking induction from essentially nothing to strong activation. But several of these types of cardiogenic transcription factors like HAN2, NKX2.5, TBX5, and TBX20 also induce at higher levels in cardiomyocytes that are regenerating. So just for the first part of the talk, to give kind of a summary of what's happening in cardiomyocytes, we think that an important part of muscle regeneration are these events. First of all, we know that the major source is cardiomyocytes, and that there are events that stimulate these myocytes to turn on this embryonic cardiogenic program. There's comprised of several of these transcription factors. And we're doing functional tests to determine the roles of these transcription factors, either increasing levels or loss of function. But upon doing that, they take on a more primitive phenotype. And we think this is important for their ability to divide and form coupled myocardium. Now, the second portion I'd just like to spend a few slides on is that the environment of the heart and how it responds to injury and how it releases signals is obviously going to be an important component of this, and we think that's probably enhanced in animals with higher regenerative capacity and reduced in animals like mammals. And when I talk about the cardiac environment, in this case, I refer to non-muscle cells of the heart, and the most prominent ones are a structure known as the endocardium and the epicardium. And what the endocardium is a specialized endothelial cell layer, and it's shown here in green. It essentially wraps around each of these inner myofibers of the adult zebrafish ventricle, essentially separating them from the lumen of the ventricle. The second type is is called the epicardium. This is in red here, and this is a mesothelial cell type that lines the periphery of all vertebrate hearts. And what we've been doing in the lab is identifying ways to isolate cell-specific expression profiles in each of these two different cell types at different points after injury to generate candidates for functional tests. And we've identified a lot of, I think, what are exciting candidate signals to help stimulate heart regeneration after injury. We're doing those functional tests, but I think what we've gotten farther on, and just for the purpose of showing you an example of one of these, I'd like to talk about the enzyme RALDH2, which is the major biosynthetic enzyme for retinoic acid synthesis. Now, RALDH2 has been studied by many during embryonic heart development. It's a great marker for the epicardium in a developing heart in a mouse or a chick, say. If we look at this marker by in situ hybridization in adult zebrafish heart, it reveals a very striking injury response, I think. And that is, if we look by whole mount in situ hybridization, the heart really shows no detectable expression of RALDH2. However, within a day of injuring by resection, removing the apex here, and here shown at 3 days, we see a response that really surprised us. It's this induction of RALDH2 message throughout the epicardium of that injured heart. So it's not only near the injury, but it's in the epicardium away from that injury site. And it's even in the uninjured chamber, the atrium here. Now, after a couple of weeks, that response largely localizes to just the epicardium around the regenerating muscle there at the apex. Now, fortunately, and again, nice for the purpose of this talk, we found something similar in that second structure I mentioned, the endocardium. RALDH2, normally, now looking at a section in situ hybridization, doesn't show detectable expression in the endocardium of the uninjured heart. However, similar to the epicardium, but in this case, even sooner following the injury, within 6 hours of an injury, there's a strong induction of this marker in endocardial cells, not only near the injury, but throughout the ventricle. We think it's occurring in all endocardial cells, and it's even in that uninjured atrium. So I'll stop and say that we've seen this kind of organ-wide response to a local injury with multiple markers. And I'll also say that we still don't know what the signal is that transmits the response to a local injury to areas throughout the heart and even in the uninjured chamber. But we think it's a very interesting dynamic response to injury that probably has something to do with regenerative capacity. Just like the epicardium, the expression of this enzyme, RALDH2, localizes to just that injury site within a day or so. And here it stays there for about 2 weeks. So in response to injury, the epicardium and the endocardium ultimately produce this area in the regenerating portion of retinoic acid synthesizing tissue. So what's its role there? Well, I mentioned retinoic acid has been studied during heart development and appears to have roles in multiple steps of heart development. We figured it was important directly or indirectly for heart regeneration, for cardiomyocyte proliferation. And so Kazu in the lab generated a simple transgenic animal to test this idea. This is one where with a heat shock inducible promoter, he generated a transgenic line where he could inducibly express a dominant negative retinoic acid receptor. And he also combined this with a strain given to us by Garrett Begeman's lab, which could inducibly express a retinoic acid degrading enzyme, CYP26. So in these experiments, what Kazu did was resect the apex from ventricles. He allowed the animals 6 days to recover and regenerate, and then gave a single heat shock to induce these constructs, and then simply looked a day later for assays for cardiomyocyte proliferation by simply labeling the myocytes in histologic stains with a co-staining with a proliferation marker. And without forcing you to look at the histology, if you just look at the graphs here, there's a very clear decrease in cardiomyocyte proliferation 1 day after blocking these retinoic acid signaling pathways. In this case, about 85% reduction, which would have a very strong effect on myocyte proliferation. So just to kind of summarize in this first part of my talk, a very skeletal model for heart regeneration to give you some idea of the questions that we and others in the field are getting at and the model that we have. Our model is that there's a dominant cardiomyocyte source, those myocytes that are spared by the injury. Injury gets them to induce factors, one of which is GATA4, but other cardiogenic transcription factors. And we think this helps generate a more primitive, less organized or de-differentiated state. But this is also combined with the fact that the hearts, in particular the non-muscle cells like the endocardium and epicardium, are particularly responsive to injury. And there are multiple factors that these are releasing that we think are facilitating the process. But just one of these that we've gotten a little further ahead on in our work is retinoic acid. And this ultimately, either directly or indirectly, is required for these cardiomyocytes to proliferate and generate coupled cardiac muscle. Now, for the next part of my talk, this is going to be all very new data. And I think that anyone in the field who wants to understand how heart regeneration might work in an adult organism has to rely heavily on what's already known and been discovered from studies of how cardiomyocytes first form during heart development in early embryos of mice or of chick or of zebrafish. So I hope I've made that point clear in the first part of my talk. But when we think about what's known about heart development in, let's say, in the zebrafish system, there's been an enormous amount of work by many very good groups that have worked out cellular mechanisms and molecular mechanisms of how a patterned heart, contracting heart, first forms. And that work has really been concentrated on the first 2 days of life. Again, the point where the embryo develops a patterned heart. But really very little is known about what happens next. And what I mean by that is as that embryo develops into a swimming larva at 10 days of life, and as that larva matures into a one-month-old juvenile animal, and then as that juvenile matures into what we use to study for regeneration, an animal that's 3 months of age or older, and you can tell there are massive changes that happen grossly in animal appearance and in animal size. And we thought by learning more about heart development and cardiac morphogenesis in these stages, this would also help us try to understand regeneration better. And so just to show the stages and the type of change that occurs during those stages that I showed you, I'm talking about the changes between 2 days post-fertilization and then the adult stage. Now, the two-day heart is comprised of about 300 cardiomyocytes total. These are formed by the differentiation of cardiac progenitors in the heart fields. And it's thought that after this stage, those 300 cardiomyocytes generate most of, if not all of, the rest of cardiac muscle through proliferation. It's also important to know, and you can tell here, that the heart at this stage is essentially a tube that's a single cardiomyocyte thick. Now, if we move forward to the adult stage, this is a scanning EM through the ventricle atrium outflow tract, and it's a very different looking structure. This is now 30 to 50,000 cardiomyocytes. It's much larger. Anatomy is very different. Generally, what's recognized is that there are two forms of cardiac muscle. One is this inner large component called trabecular muscle. This is organized into long, elaborate myofibers known as trabeculae. And then surrounding that is this outer layer referred to as compact muscle. This is filled with vasculature. It's also surrounded by the epicardium that I referred to. So how does this turn into this? There's really not much known about this, and it's a little more difficult to study, I would say, than those early stages. What one would ideally want to do is be able to give each of these cardiomyocytes some kind of unique tag, and then to follow those cardiomyocytes individually as this structure changes into this structure, and then kind of interpret what we've seen those labeled cells do. And some of you might recognize one technology that could allow this, and I think the best technology there is for labeling lots of cells with different tags, and that is Brainbow methodology. This was developed by Jeff Lippmann's lab a few years ago at Harvard. And this is a way that one can give unique color tags to individual cells within a like population of cells, and eventually then follow those cells by following their colors. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with this, I can go through the methodology here. It's relatively simple. What one does is generate a transgenic strain, and this was used first in mice, of course, that drives a construct with three fluorescent reporters in this variety of Brainbow. And it also has strategically placed paired LOXP sites. So in a transgenic animal with a limiting amount of Cre recombinase, a cell can see a few different possibilities with recombination. First of all, there could be no recombination, and that cell would show expression of this red reporter. If there's recombination with the black LOXP sites, then one would see expression of the green reporter shown. And if the white sites are chosen randomly, stochastically, one would see expression of the blue. So a cell has those choices. And the best scenario is if there are many copies of this transgene in a cell, and if these sites are chosen randomly, you can get a much more diverse set of colors. So in the case of three transgenes in a cell, there are ultimately 10 unique color combinations, 10 unique colors one can achieve. And if there are more copies, there are more colors. So what Vikas Gupta, who's an MD, PhD student in the lab, wanted to do was to label cardiomyocytes in that two-day-old embryonic heart with as many colors as he could, and then follow them throughout life. So he used this strain that I've referred to, inducible Cre recombinase specific to cardiomyocytes. He generated many of these lines, and we call these lines prism lines, not Brainbow, so I may say prism during this talk. And he found lines that recombined well in this double transgenic scenario. And so his experiment was relatively simple. What he did was he gave a transient puff or introduction of tamoxifen to the two-day-old embryo. So in what I'll show you, this is all the labeling took place at this time point. And then he looked at multiple periods throughout development where he simply sampled hearts and looked for color combinations through the juvenile stage and into the adult stages. And then he tried to interpret what he saw with those colors. So here's the first stage he looked at, which is a 10-day-old larval heart. And there are a few different things I want to point out here. This is an image of just the surface myocardium of the ventricle. And what you can see here, so this is about a week after the labeling. What you can see here is that there are multiple colors that he could generate. And that's one of the key things. And then secondly, it appeared that we could label individual cells. This is very high magnification. So this is an individual cell here. In most cases, individual cells with different colors were aligned next to each other. Sometimes it looked like maybe there were two cells of one color next to each other. We think this happened through cell division after that labeling. So by having this diversity of colors, we thought that it would be possible to interpret larger clones of colors as we see these animals grow and their hearts get larger. I also want to show you a section through the ventricle at this stage. You see all these colors here. I just want to point out a few things. First of all, the wall of the ventricle is still a single cardiomyocyte thick at this stage, as it was at 2 days. However, you can see all these trabeculae have formed. These have formed in the last week. And what I want you to pay attention to is the junctions between the cardiomyocytes on the wall here and in these trabeculae. You can see that largely they're different colors. So here's a red myocyte and a blue one next to each other. Here's a red one and kind of a greenish one. What this means is that these trabeculae didn't form simply by the cardiomyocytes here dividing and giving rise to this trabecular sprout. But instead, this cardiomyocyte had to come from somewhere else and delaminate from the wall, separate from the wall, and then attach here and start forming this trabeculae. That is, these are not clonally related to each other. And this is the dominant mechanism for how trabeculae seem to be forming. That is, they seem to be detaching from the wall, going somewhere else in the chamber itself, and then attaching in a new location to form a trabecular fiber. And work from Didier Stanier's lab had suggested that definitely this appears to happen, but I think this visually shows that it's a dominant mechanism. And you can also now see that a trabecular myofiber is comprised of many different clones or non-clonally related cardiac myocytes because of their use of the different colors you see in each of these fibers. So those are just a few things you can detect from this type of approach.